Well, welcome. It's great to see you here for this session. My name is Jeff Nielsen. I'll be moderating this panel discussion. We're here to talk about dialogue in the church and dialogue between the generations. And what I want to do is just spend a couple of minutes making a few introductory comments and telling you what we have done before today with this dialogue group. And then we want to more or less continue the dialogue by I will be asking the panelists, and what we have done over the past, let's see, Monday and Tuesday night, we spent 2 hours dialoguing together on a particular issue that I'll tell you about in just a second. And so in a few minutes after I've introduced the dialogue process and some of these ideas, I'm going to have them introduce themselves, and then I'll ask them some questions about the dialogue for them to sort of reflect on their feelings and their experience. And after each round of questions that I ask them, we'll turn to the audience and allow you to either respond to the questions that I ask the panel or to ask the panelists questions yourself that you might have about this dialogue experience. So that's more or less the format. They don't know what was happening, but now you know. So I hope you're prepared with profound thoughts. Let me begin with a few words of introduction about dialogue. In our institutional lives, you know, in family, church, and work, I think we're used to guarded conversations and to, in some ways, merely self-expression. And that's usually juxtaposed against rank-based leadership authority. And it's very difficult in that context to have a dialogue. And then in the church, I think sometimes when we have a conflict or a difference of opinion, what we tend to do is quote some authority or bear our testimony. And that often has a tendency of closing down the conversation. So again, it's quite difficult to change our minds and introduce a new paradigm or a new idea of dialogue, because dialogue is slow, it's risky, it's unpredictable. Today is unpredictable. We'll see what happens. Dialogue rejects coercion and manipulation, and it opts instead for openness, transparency, and sincere listening, first with yourself and then with others. Dialogue, and maybe they might speak to this if they felt some frustration over the past couple of nights, but dialogue decides that a little bit of frustration in the short term is worth building long-term relationships, meaningful relationships in the long term. In genuine dialogue as well, you shouldn't expect that others will change their mind or their behavior to match yours. We need to instead respect the inherent empirical limitations of being a human being. I mean, if we think about it, hardly any of us, if any of us at all, are really fully aware, let alone able to change our basic preconceptions, unexamined prejudices, implicit biases, ingrained ideologies, and dogmatic certainties. It has taken us our entire lifetime, if you think about it, our entire lifetime up to this point, to build that background set of beliefs and values. So it's only natural to expect some internal resistance to changing those background beliefs and values and being open to talk about them in a dialogue session. So the goal of dialogue is to provide a safe place to allow us to talk with others. It allows us a safe place where we can be vulnerable and hopefully explore ours and others' deeply held values, beliefs, and assumptions. The objective of dialogue is not consensus. The objective of dialogue is not agreement. In fact, the objective of dialogue is not even to reach a decision. In other words, the objective of dialogue is to allow each one of us to say to the other person, "Oh, I understand. I understand why you believe what you do and what you believe. And you know what? It's not stupid or immoral or naive and wishful thinking or naive or simple-minded at all." That's the objective of dialogue, to bring us to that point. What each of us, I think, is after, and it came out of our discussion, and some members mentioned this of our panel discussion, that what each one of us ultimately really wants, I think, in life is to be valued and respected. We want to be irreplaceable in the affection and love of those that we care most deeply about. And dialogue is both the pathway and the sign, I think, that we've achieved that status in our religious community. Now, the benefits of dialogue as well are kind of intangible. Whether it's the satisfaction of being able to truthfully speak what you believe, to speak your mind and have other people actually listen to you, or maybe it's the experience of that sacred bond that can emerge when you actually listen to someone else and understand why they believe and think the way they do. Maybe one of the most The greatest intangible benefits of dialogue is that very sacred experience you have when you sincerely come to understand and respect and value the belief of someone else you might not entirely agree with, but come to value and respect anyway. So dialogue, I think, is a personal task and a community obligation that each of us face. So what we have done is we came together, and I really like the way it was expressed in the Sunstone Symposium booklet. Let me just read the first part of this abstract. It said, "Many Mormons of the younger generation feel isolated or frustrated when their conception of Mormonism clashes with that of their parents or leaders. This frustration is often compounded by a feeling of voicelessness, as youth find it difficult to express their views at home or in church. In turn, parents and leaders can feel misunderstood as they try to express their beliefs while showing love." With that kind of as a background, we came together on Monday night and Tuesday night, 2 hours each. And the issue that we began to talk about was how our individual experiences and feelings of our faith in the church affect our relationships to one another. In particular, how we can have conflicts in our faith, or conflicts in the way we see the church or our beliefs, and how those conflicts affect how we see ourselves and how we see those that we love. Is it possible in that difficult situation for dialogue to really take place? That's more or less what we wanted to find out a couple of nights ago. So now let me just take a couple of minutes to let the panel introduce themselves. And right now, if you don't mind, if you could just perhaps give us your name and maybe 30 seconds about who you are. Just kind of a brief introduction, and then we'll start to ask some questions about the dialogue experience and let the audience participate as well.
Church, served a mission, went to BYU for 6 years, sang in Motown, and came out to my parents and everyone else as gay 2 years ago. So that's been an interesting journey navigating that path with them. They're very devout LDS, and it's been an interesting process.
Hello, my name's Ryan Nielsen. I was invited as well by Ashley Sanders, but also it's my father, so.
It's my son. Very proud of him.
And it's been an interesting journey for me the past couple of years, and I think lately I've been really wanting to understand how to communicate with other people, so understanding this dialogue, I think, will be important in relating to people, and,
My name is Tristan Call. From Huntsville, Alabama, and my parents happened to be in town, and so did the dialogue with me. And I've been at BYU for about 4 years, just currently graduating next week. And while there, got involved in a variety of kinds of human rights activism, including gay rights activism there. And as a result of several years of that, became a little bit less and less comfortable with the mainstream church, and also saw some rifts in what had been very strong relationships with my parents and a couple of siblings. And so it's also been something really interesting to explore with my parents there as well.
My name is Katie Savage. I'm a BYU graduate going to the University of Utah right now. I asked my mom to come to this dialogue with me, and her response was, "We have religious differences." And so I was not there with my parents, but I'm dating Tristan, so it was very interesting to try to sort things out with his parents. I think to describe where I am spiritually, I might be the cautionary tale against your daughters becoming environmentalists, because they slowly edge over into pantheism, which I think is where I'm headed. So my mother and I do have religious differences, for the record.
My name is Roy Chapman. I'm a convert to the church. I'm a father and a grandfather. And I'm also a graduate of BYU many years ago. I'm currently serving in the church as a bishop, and I'm pleased to be here with these nice people.
My name's Toby Pingree. I've been on the Sunstone board for about 8 years now, and I was, I think, enlisted to come in this project as a church authority, although I'm not one now. It's been a while. I've been a bishop 3 times and been mission president. And I was, the experience is, in a nutshell, Jeff mentioned that dialogue is often is difficult when people take strong positions. I don't. There was nothing said by the panelists that are here now in the dialogue that I had any problem with. I was very delighted to find out that we're on the same page mostly.
Maybe that was a problem, but we'll talk about that.
My name is Ashley Sanders, and I organized this dialogue and asked Jeff to moderate because I'm very. Well, partly because I took Jeff's class at BYU a few years ago, and it ruined my life in a very positive way. I've never been comfortable with hierarchy since. And he talked a lot in his class about ways we can change the structure of classrooms and organizations of all kinds to make everybody feel like they have a voice. And I believe very strongly that voicelessness is the result less of unkindness than of structures that create minorities that cannot speak. So I wanted to organize something that gave people who felt possibly mutually embattled but who loved each other a chance to speak to each other. And my parents also attended. A lot of parents attended who couldn't make it today, but my parents are really wonderful and supportive. But Jeff will talk about this later, I'm sure, but we talked about the different stages of dialogue, and sometimes my parents and I try to support each other so much that we never break out of the politeness stage, and so we're all getting kinder and kinder and not talking about the elephant in the room. And so they came, and it was really, I really appreciated that. I'm very interested in people having forums where they can express strong emotions and not be delegitimized because they are angry or sad or frustrated, and where people have to listen to each other.
My name is Elizabeth Pinborough, and I think I was an indirect beneficiary of Jeff Nielsen's class through Ashley. But Ashley invited me to do this. I attended discussion night, which Ashley held for how many years? 5 years. I didn't go for 5 years, but it was for 2 years, where this sort of dialogue went on all the time. But I've learned to be more vocal and to express my opinions, and this dialogue also helped me in discussing things with my parents. So I hope we'll be able to continue working on that.
Good, thank you. I think I'll have Ashley write a blurb for my next book. This book ruined my life in a positive way.
In a good way.
In a good way, yes, in a good way. Well, let me, again, I want to start to ask some questions about the dialogue process and get you involved as well. So please be thinking about thoughts and ideas and comments and observations you might have yourself about dialogue. We did, when we started this dialogue last Monday, we went over some ground rules that need to govern that dialogue interaction. And those ground rules are, number one, listen sincerely. Number two is to speak truthfully. I mean, dialogue isn't going to take place, one, if people aren't willing to speak truthfully about how they feel and what their experiences have been, and if they're not listened to sincerely. The other ground rules, one was to try to recognize all viewpoints, because it's obviously going to happen in a dialogue that there are different viewpoints that you're aware of that aren't represented in the room. And so for a genuine dialogue to take place, you want to somehow include those as well. And like Ashley mentioned, some of the parents who participated in this dialogue who had different views aren't here tonight, so we want to make sure that if we can, that we represent those views as faithfully as possible as well. Another ground rule was to take responsibility for quiet participants. If you're like me, when I'm in a setting like this, I usually am very quiet and don't speak very much, though I have very profound things to say. But it's important in a dialogue, if you see someone who you know has something they would like to say but might be shy or reticent, to make sure that they're included. And then the last, or the two other ground rules, one was to respect time constraints so that no one monopolized the discussion. And the last one was to practice reciprocity, which essentially means that in the dialogue, you have to try to see and treat others the way you would want to be seen and treated. So those are the ground rules. Now, just very quickly, the stages of dialogue that Ashley mentioned that I want to lay out for you, and then they can perhaps express how they felt we went through this. But there are four stages in a dialogue experience. The first stage is politeness. When you bring people together, they're very kind, they're very considerate, they don't want to give any offense. And so you have a lot of politeness. In a politeness stage of dialogue, differences and disagreements are considered liabilities. What happens, though, eventually, is if you get them to talk, you move into the next stage, the second stage, which is called conflict or opposition. And that's where differences of opinion begin to get expressed in the dialogue, in the group. Now, there's a danger when you reach that second stage. And maybe, Toby, we didn't quite get there. I would like to get the group's thought. But in the second stage, where you start to see differences of agreement or differences of opinion, what tends to happen is one of two things. Either people decide to retreat back into politeness because they don't want to offend, and so you don't really get anywhere. Or the second thing that can happen is that people can get so irate and so set on their views that you get polarization that takes place. And in that second stage of conflict or opposition, disagreements and differences are considered threats. They're considered dangerous. Well, hopefully in a dialogue, you persevere through that conflict stage. And then you get to the third stage, which is listening. And that's where sincere listening begins to take place, where you really start paying attention to the feelings and the views of the other people. In that listening stage, differences and disagreements and individuality are considered interesting, intriguing, thought-provoking. And then hopefully you get from there to the final stage of dialogue, which is dialogue itself, the give and take of conversation, where differences and disagreements and individuality are considered assets to the group, assets for future growth and development. So with that said, what I would like to begin to do is to ask the group, and at this point, any of them that want to speak to this can. And after the panels have had a chance to speak, I would like to ask you in the audience to perhaps respond to this, or if you have any questions for our panelists, that would be the time to ask. And we'll go through a series of questions. The first one I want to ask the panelists are what obstacles they experienced in the dialogue process that we had. What obstacles to genuine communication did you find in yourself and perhaps in others? So let's begin with that obstacle stage. What made it difficult for genuine dialogue to take place? Any thoughts from the panelists on that? Obstacles. As we were having the dialogue, and you can think about your own experience with dialogue, what obstacles, what roadblocks to genuine communication have you experienced? Or in our dialogue that we had, as you think about those stages of dialogue, what obstacles did you find in yourself, perhaps in your emotions, in your responses to what others said, and that sort of thing?
Again, she means the general topic.
Oh, Jessica?
Did you mean the general topic?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes. I said that. Weren't you paying attention? I'm joking. The general topic is, how do our differences in our experience and feelings about the church, how do they affect our relationships with those closest to us? How do the differences in our sense of commitment and belief or unbelief affect the way we relate to our family members or to our close friends? So, go ahead.
Okay, I'm addressing the dialogue process we went through, where we had 20 of us in a room for 2 hours. There were too many of us almost. I mean, you didn't get a chance to. Most people didn't get a chance to talk as much as they probably wanted to. I don't know what you can say about that. I think it's good to have the people who are there, great people to have. Regarding the specific issue about something in the church, I think the one that we addressed that came home most to us was problems that a number of us have had with church situations where we have been perceived as being hostile, angry to the church because we don't follow the line of whatever has been said officially by the church is right, and by either the church leader or in church policy. And of course, I guess the amendment of California was on the lines and some other things too. But I think that was the one where, and we felt that we cited experiences with church members like that, where where really the conversation doesn't go anywhere because that's a non-negotiable by most church members. Mm-hmm. And I think most of the people on the panel, that's very much negotiable.
I guess I'll just say that the first obstacle that seems most that was most obvious to me, I guess, throughout was that it wasn't an isolated situation with a beginning and an end. These are relationships that are ongoing, right, and that preceded the dialogue. And maybe that's too obvious to mention, but I think that was a huge obstacle to a lot of people. You don't say things to people when you're worried that the things you might say might affect your relationship negatively in the future. So,
I think that's true. I think the difficulty that we have in our modern society is that we're so concerned about not offending someone that we never really get past the polite stage, is that we're so concerned about being polite and nice to each other that we never really get to the heart of the issue that we would like to discuss.
So are you asking obstacles that we found in ourselves personally as well?
Right. One of the difficulties to dialogue is that we often project onto others the difficulties that are really within us. So when you confront someone who feels or thinks or sees things differently than you do, the tendency is to feel like you're being attacked or to be nervous. So what sort of obstacles in yourself to being open to sincere listening and truthful speaking did you find?
Well, the first thing I think... Okay, I just forgot the first thing. Okay, the second thing that I found... Oh, I remember, okay. I do think that a lot of times... Well, I realized that a lot of times my parents are, particularly my mom, I think my dad is more like me in this way, that they're willing to talk, and I have projected my fear of talking onto them, and I realize that they ask me all the time what I think and how I feel, and I'm usually like, I'm just really tired, or, you know, I ignore it or something, right, or avoid it, because it's really, really, really painful to start talking about those things. So that's the first thing, I think, the barrier is just trying to get over that fear of having, like, okay, here we go, into the trenches, we're having this conversation. And secondly, just trying to start this off on an honest note for myself, one of the barriers was that I have felt increasingly angry over the years at being a minority, or what I perceive to be a minority in the church, and of not being able to feel like I could have my voice be heard, or of getting very similar comments in reaction to the things I've said for years and years and years and years. And it has gotten so frustrated that it's very difficult, frustrating that it's difficult not to be bitter, and it's so hard to know how to come into a situation and say, this is what I think, and know what parts of your history to give to someone so they could empathize with you, and vice versa. And also, I think that's difficult in a church that really, really delegitimizes anger, like I said earlier, in a lot of ways. And if you're angry, then there's something wrong with you, and that the brunt of that usually falls on the dissenting voice or the minority voice, so that you, almost in saying what you feel, lose your ability to be, legitimately say what you feel. Mm-hmm. That was a problem that I went in there feeling.
Okay. Tristan, do you have another thought?
One of the things that we talked about in the early kind of preparing stages of the dialogue the first night was the way that Jeff put it, was the reptile brain, ways that when you're threatened, you'll freeze, or you'll flee, or you'll fight, right? Some, I guess, basic brain chemistry going on. And talking about, you know, ways to deal with that would be to articulate it. You express and you pause and you say, I'm feeling attacked right now. Or you say, or if you notice that you're doing it to someone else, and I'm sorry, I didn't mean to threaten you with that. That wasn't my intention, or that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And I think that one of the obstacles that I found, not in the dialogue itself, because I don't think that it came out quite as much, but my parents were in town. We did the dialogue 2 hours Monday night, 2 hours Tuesday night. And so I had... Now, the other 22 hours of the day to kind of process and follow up and those sorts of things with my parents. And one of the things that, after expressing what Ashley expressed, My father said later at another time of Ashley, she seems really angry, which was, you know, he was listening well, right? I mean, she was angry at the time. And it was interesting how much credibility she lost as a result of admitting that, with my father specifically. And I think that it's a really, really helpful thing within dialogue to, you know, go to that level of expressing how do I feel as I'm talking. And yet the very act of expressing a feeling made my father listen less, I think, to the other things that she was saying, right? And this is not a surprise. This happens in a religious community in which anger is delegitimized, right? And I think that, collecting myself, the reason that that was so surprising to me was that there are other angry people, you know, in the room or in my father's life, or that also have contact with him, that don't admit that, and that wouldn't say it out loud, and thus don't lose that credibility. And I think that it was, you know, it's a really damaging thing. And you know, maybe after a long time of dialogue, that can get past that. I'm curious to see, you know, your experience or others with this issue. Because I found that despite everyone agreed, everyone needs to share their emotions and how they feel in order to have a good dialogue. My father didn't disagree with that. What he disagreed with was the anger itself. And so you agree, share how you feel. But if you do share how you feel, then I will hold it against you, and that will affect the way that I listen to you and the way that I evaluate you.
Yeah, that's a very interesting point. Let's turn to our audience here and get some of your thoughts. If you do have some, you can come up to the microphone. And again, in your own experience of talking to people across differences of opinion or differences of experience or belief and faith in the church, what obstacles have you come across? So go ahead, Jessica.
I was just going to follow up on the anger comment real quickly. I just have read different books and heard things, and a lot of people talk about anger as really being some kind of fear, and I just wondered if anyone had a comment.
Any comment? Or anyone else who wants to speak in the audience can come up and... Yes, go ahead.
I was struck by the parallel between your four steps of dialogue and Scott Peck's four stages of community.
Yes, they're synonymous.
They are. And when I met Scott Peck, who is the one who told me about Sunstone in 1988, I think it was, in Colorado at a conference where he was a speaker, and they didn't know, made it known to him that I was Mormon. And he said, well, do you know Sunstone? And I said, no, Sunstone. Well, Sunstone is what I would consider stage three community, where I would consider the LDS church itself, he said, is an ideal example of stage one, pseudo-community. Mm-hmm. And then stage two, which is chaos, is where someone starts telling the truth, whatever it is, and then the stage three emptying, when that runs its course, you go into true community,
right,
which is what you're talking about, dialogue. Mm-hmm. And so I thought that whole idea of allowing the chaos to speak and getting it out and empty is the key to moving on.
Yes. We found, though, one of the dangers that Tristan brought up was that there are some people who when they experience that feeling or they see that in someone else, that they then, I guess, thinks less of the person or that credibility is lost. That seems to be a real obstacle to any genuine dialogue taking place if a person can't express their emotions without it being respected and valued. Go ahead.
A few thoughts come to mind about anger. Just last night, we were talking with a sister-in-law of mine. Her husband just came out that he's wants to leave the church. It feels like it coming out, and with all the reverberations. And anyway, my brother-in-law's reaction was something about wanting to hit him, you know, to get make. I don't know how I put it, but something physical, violent. And my sister-in-law said, you'd be surprised how many people had that same response. And I said, wow, I just don't see the point. I just want to talk to him. I'm really curious. There's got to be so much under that for him to come out. That's really courageous. I'd really like to know, you know, how he's doing. But I thought that was very interesting in light of what you were saying. So did people's response was an anger/violent response. And
nonsense influence.
Yeah, that kind of idea, exactly. Mm-hmm. The other thought I had as far as anger, sometimes with me, I respect it, but I do feel like it's a roadblock.
Right.
And so I want to kind of let that person drain the anger with me. Like, okay, tell me about it. How you're feeling. But I don't feel like I can really communicate with them when they're in that place.
Right.
And then the third thing I would say, and the final thing I would say is for myself, anger often motivates me to communicate. But it's usually a secondary response. My first response is something more sad or vulnerable, but I'm not as functional in that space. It makes me want to curl up or cry. So I transition from a sadness, vulnerability to an anger, and then I can talk and debate and get it out there. And so, you know, my husband doesn't like to talk to me in my anger, but I'm saying this is the place where I actually can verbalize and be logical and,
Well, if someone, and we talked about this in the session, Tristan talked about the different way the brain responds to conflict, and the first response that Tristan brought out was the reptile brain that feels like it's being attacked or threatened. And we all know what that's like. You probably have had that experience of being offended by someone before, and you kind of freeze up. And you don't know what to say, and you kind of stumble around. And then, like 30 seconds later, you come back with the best comeback, but they've already gone, so it's too late. See, we've all had that experience. What happens is after that moment of conflict and threat, where you freeze up, your brain is able to process it, and you can become more rational. But in that moment of being threatened, there is no possibility of rationality on your part or logical response. It's instinctive, fight, flee, or freeze. The other thing we have to listen for are emotions, and we talked about this as well. If you're dialoguing with someone and you recognize that they're getting agitated and all upset and emotional, which is a good thing to be, you have to realize that you can't talk. You have to just listen, and we all sort of intuitively know that. The best response to a person's emotion is sincere listening. You allow them to breathe and to be affirmed, and then you can perhaps proceed to dialogue. But emotions are very tricky things. And we talk, and now let's come back to the panel, but we talked about emotions. Emotions we sometimes think are true or false, but they're not. Emotions don't tell us anything about the objective world. They give us information about ourselves. So the interesting question with emotions when you're feeling anger or fear or whatever the emotion might be is not to ask what that emotion tells me about the world, but what information is that emotion giving me about myself that you can begin to process and think about.
And it's so much more helpful the person you're talking to say, what's going on for you there? I can see you're having...
Right.
Response, instead of saying, oh, it's obviously not a good time for you to talk
to your anger. So let's ask the panelists, if you don't mind. Thank you for that. Let's ask the panelists during this dialogue, and actually we're all looking at you, no, just me. During that dialogue, I think you probably went through various emotions. If you think about that now, what were those emotions, what information were those emotions giving you about yourself in that dialogue that might be helpful now to think about for future conversations? Would anybody like to respond to that?
Second night to the dialogue after having been in the library all day reading two books, The Lord's University and House of Faith, about the history of BYU. And I'm not sure if you have read those books or not, but I felt like I had reached a limit, and not the first limit of my life, but kind of a triple, quadruple limit
on reading about things that I consider to be unjust and wrong at BYU and in my religion, and then trying to communicate them to people and having people say, well, it doesn't matter, or the church is good, just focus on the good, or work on the inside, or don't get angry, or the church needs you, or all these things that I feel like I've heard 50 million times, and instead I wish somebody would just say, well, tell me about what probably is a very long story about why you feel that way. So I don't think that my anger, at least, is fear, unless it's a kind of resignation, which is maybe a form of fear, of feeling like if I speak, the response to my speaking will increase how I'm feeling rather than decrease it, because I will, like I said before, lose my legitimacy as I try to explain myself. And so I think what I learned from myself, if there is an initial emotion before fear or before anger, like you were saying, for me it is a sense of injustice, and I feel injustice intensely, and it's not a self-serving emotion. I feel sorrow for people who had to suffer under what I think are unfair systems or unfair rules or hypocrisies, and then I try to speak about them, and then I feel anger because the response to my sense of injustice seems so blunted often and so resigned or so unimaginative, or I feel like it criminalizes people who respond keenly to injustice, and it makes me really, really frustrated. So I was dealing a lot with feeling overwhelmed about how to express myself without getting more reactions that would make me feel more of what I felt, and also feeling to be, and I'm trying to be really honest, and I know it's hard for me to be honest about this because I do feel like people often consider people who are honest in my situation to be whiners, like, oh, why don't you, you know, like, the most common argument at BYU is, if you don't like it, go to Berkeley, you know? And there was that comment, someone did an article about the honor code presentation I did yesterday, and they were like, at least 15, why don't you go to Berkeley's in there? And it was like, why don't you go to a new joke camp or something? I was so annoyed. But anyway, I feel like it's hard to be part of something that you want to love, but constantly be directed away from that desire to love by feeling like your attempts to love are thwarted. And I don't mean to make myself out to be the heroine of my own self-styled story, but that is what I was feeling for the majority of the time. And I think it would have been better for it to have been a lot longer, although that would have been harder, because I felt like we were just starting to get into those things about other people, not just myself, of course, but other people as well. And then we had to go home, which was hard, and I know a lot of people would like to stay longer. Anyway, I don't know, John, did you want to say something? Sure. Not to make you sorry.
I'm going to use two strong words that we tossed around in the car afterwards that reflect in some ways how I feel or felt after the discussion. Those two words are a sense of despair and a sense of hopelessness, which sounds so bleak, I'm sorry. I wanted to use those words because I think that that gets at the heart of what we didn't really get to in our dialogue or discussion, but it was almost tangible in the air, at least among those of us who are from the younger generation who really didn't get to give voice to what we felt in the ways that we wanted to. I think because we were afraid, like you were saying, that we wouldn't be understood or that our anger would be interpreted as being directed at our parents. My parents were there. And I knew that it was a huge thing just for my parents to come. I mean, when I asked my mom to come to this Sunstone discussion, she said, oh, Sunstone, isn't that that group in Arizona who are no longer Mormons? Not to vilify my mom, but she's a wonderful, sweet woman, and she's amazing and incredibly devoted to the church. But for her, this was this incredibly foreign thing. But for her, I honestly think she felt like she was being really kind and even just making the effort to come, even just beginning, like sitting there to have the dialogue. But we didn't get to the real dialogue. And so I think that the times that I feel that sense of despair or hopelessness is when I get some of those traditional responses that Ashley was talking about, which are, in my case, as a gay, disenfranchised Mormon, that, you know, I love you and I support you, but the prophet has spoken, and what the prophet is saying, you know, the buck stops there, so to speak. And also that I just want you to be happy, and I want you to be happy in your own way, which is frustrating sometimes to hear from people who are LDS, because I was incredibly devout LDS and voracious reader of LDS theology all my life, and I know that that's not really true in a sense, that there's a belief that real joy comes by abiding by the precepts and commandments of the gospel. And so they say, you know, in this kind of placating way, like, we just want you to be happy. But I know they don't really believe that I'm going to be. And so it's kind of infuriating. They come back at you with this real sense of, like, I think it's a genuine kind of kindness and sweetness, but that's where the anger comes from, because you feel like there's no real getting to the core. I would almost rather that they say to me, in real kind of tenacity and anger, like, I think you're not going to be happy because you're living this lifestyle, which is hard to hear, but which is true. You know, I want to get to that conflict stage, which we never did. Anyway,
I think still respond to the question about anger. I apologize if anyone was in a session yesterday where I also talked about this, but I think that there's a particular psychological theory that I haven't been able to stop thinking about for the last few days. It's really useful in talking about the particular situation that Ashley described. It's Gregory Bateson and the double bind theory. And essentially the point of it is to explain how schizophrenia develops. I won't go into that story on how he does it, or how he explains it, but essentially the idea is you have two directives, two commandments, if you will, which in some way conflict, so that if you follow one, so that no matter what you do, you will be punished in some way. So the idea is you have one commandment, for example, that would say, share what you really think with me, and if you don't, then I won't trust you, or if you don't, then I won't understand you, or that sort of idea. And the second might be, but if you're angry, then I also won't trust you, or also won't take what you say seriously. And I think that what you have there then is if you share your feelings about being angry, then you're punished for it. And if you don't share your feelings about being angry, then also you're punished for it, because you don't get the result you're after. You don't get to actually share. Now, the twisted side of this is that as a result, you can't decide, you know, whether to express your feelings. So the fear, so the question about is anger fear, then you have the additional problem, well, could I somehow clarify these commandments? Is it more important to you that I respond, you know, hopefully, or is it more acceptable to you that I really share what I'm feeling? And if you ask that question, then you'll also be punished. Because the whole point is, well, what do you mean? Didn't you trust that I really wanted to hear how you feel? Or don't you also understand that anger is wrong? Or that sort of thing. So you run into the situation where it can be very paralyzing to try to respond in any way. And Bateson explains how this drives people into schizophrenia when it's done from a young age, in which you're actually punished for understanding what people are saying. So you drive yourself into ignoring what people are actually telling you. I think this is a really helpful way to think about expression of honest emotion, particularly. Honest opinion as well, but specifically honest emotion within the church. You must be honest, but if your honesty is not in line, then you must not do that either. And so you have two conflicting directives there. Mm-hmm.
Does the audience have any thoughts about that or experiences with this topic? Go ahead.
I want to ask all of you young people, do you have any encouragement where you are for dream work? Are you encouraged to share your dreams? And do you share your dreams with each other? And do you know how to do that?
I share my dreams with many, but I don't have any, I haven't heard of this official dream work.
Let's kind of broaden that question. One of the ideas about having this dialogue was that for the younger generation to talk to the older generation. So perhaps we can get Bishop and Toby, some of your thoughts on, and Lori as well, about what the, I hate to say older generation, that seems so, don't take offense by that. But we've been hearing a lot from the younger members of our panel about the hopelessness and despair they feel when they try to share honest opinions and thoughts and beliefs with their parents or those that love them. Because on one hand, if they do, they're rejected. On the other hand, if they don't, there's that dishonesty that tends to corrupt the relationships. There's a real catch-22 double bind present. Let's have some of the panelists who are on the other side of that divide, perhaps, if that's the right way to put it, speak to how they perceive the struggles and wrestles with truth that the younger generation has. So would anybody like to speak to that?
I feel frustrated when I hear these young people talk, not only tonight but in our previous meetings, because I feel like I'm helpless and not able to help them. And I think that's where I feel bad. I don't necessarily agree with their opinion, but I certainly agree with their right to speak. In my background as a convert to the church, I joined when I was 19, and then my wife and I, after we were married, we moved around considerably and had a lot to do with non-members. And then when we retired, we went on a mission to England. And there are a lot of people in our ward in London that were entirely different from us. And there were a lot of black members from Africa. And my wife and I really got to love them and what sweet people they were. And so I think, to me, my experience leads me to a feeling of acceptance of other people that are different than the way that I am. I may not agree with them, but I think I can offer them respect and acceptance. And so we've had a wonderful experience, wonderful life, in being able to draw a circle and draw a lot of people in. And I think that's what we all need, it seems to me, more is to not have this anger and bitterness, and that's tragic, but those of us that are older to have more of a feeling of acceptance and respect to these young people, even though I feel helpless and not able to help them at all in their problem, I certainly respect their right to express their feelings.
Since I joined the group late, I'm not sure if they had instruction beforehand.
No, they didn't.
Okay. And the concept that Tristan brought up about schizophrenia is something that we deal with in life, in the church, in our day-to-day relationships, because are we being authentic? And there's such a thing as schizophrenia, but I think we all deal with authenticity, and whether we're walking the line or we're pretending to walk the line. And since no one's perfect, everyone's fallible, everyone makes mistakes, and we sin, and we are hypocritical, and members of our family are hypocritical. Members in our ward are hypocritical. The politicians. So, as a result, where do we go with that? How do we decide to go through the steps that we went through in this evening experience and the stages of politeness to conflict, to listening, to dialogue, but then going the extra step to actual action, decision making, because I don't think it stops with dialogue. And I'll stop there for now.
Would anyone from the younger generation like to respond to any of those thoughts or share your thoughts? Elizabeth?
Okay.
You had the mic, so I...
Yeah. Copy. I guess I'll just sort of give voice to what my mom and I talked about after the dialogue, because I sort of feel like we started to actually approach what we would call dialogue after the panel. She was just expressing, I don't know, her and I heard some of the other, you know, parents and adults say this, but just her devotion to the church and how I guess she chooses not to dissent. At the end of our last meeting, I sort of said, will you sort of, you know, bore your testimony of anti-dissent? And she was like, well, yeah, sort of. Well, yeah, I guess I'm not really okay with dissent, you know. And I basically told her that I am more okay with it than she is. And I did get very angry at her because, you know, she sort of held to her, you know, faithful testimony, and which I do too, but it's hard to find sort of a middle ground between, you know, testimony and dialogue. Not that there is a middle ground, but so I don't know, and I don't think we even actually approached dialogue because I still ended up sort of selectively listening to what she had to say and kind of ignoring her half the time and being a little confrontational and like, well, so, and asking her a lot of rapid-fire questions. But I think we've started to approach understanding, and she was able to be very honest with me, even if I couldn't be as honest with her. But I do think... And she also didn't like being placed in, you know, sort of this stereotypical category of the older generation because I think she does hold some unconventional views. But, you know, she's chosen that path because she feels like she wants to experience what she would call sort of the full, all of the blessings that the gospel has to offer, including, you know, temple covenants and things like that. And based on, you know, strong spiritual experiences and especially the conversion experience that her mother had. So, and I think she feels maybe that in dialogue those things are downplayed a little bit. But I think it can be the other way around. So, this is a tricky question. So.
Well, let's turn it back to our audience. You've heard some of the frustration and difficulty that they had in a more formal session of dialogue. But I'm sure that many of you have had dialogue or conversation with people in different generations, or even in the same generation, where you had a difference of view, a difference of commitment or belief, and you found that you were simply unable to communicate. Would anybody in the audience like to perhaps share that sort of experience? And if they didn't, and did anything successful to resolve that? Mark?
You know, what I'm hearing here, and of course it's already been spoken of, is missing is really what I term authentic listening. And that's really where we don't even get to that point. I mean, I've been in countless elders quorum meetings where it's, you know, if there's one little thing that's off the beaten path that's mentioned, the subject is usually changed. Nobody really listens. It's just this same stuff over and over again, which I get tired of it. And that seems to be the base issue, is just that listening is not there. I had the same issue that John was dealing with when I came out to my parents a number of years ago. Mm-hmm. And there was the... there was the love shown, the kindness, but always, you know, your heart is grasped by Satan, letter that I got from my mother. And she never really let go of that viewpoint. Mm-hmm. There was never an authentic listening. And you know what? I don't think I've listened very authentically either, honestly. And, you know, she's passed now, and we never really got to that point. So that seems to be a real battle.
Right. I think in many ways Ashley's motivation in bringing us together was because those damaged relationships or that failure to reach authentic relationships with those you love is a tragic thing. And not to be able to have those honest, open communication, that transparency between people, is very, very tough to deal with, and to try to address that is important. Did you have a thought, sir?
Yeah, I
could.
And I think Lloyd does as well.
Lloyd? Okay.
One of the things, the thoughts that I had as I was just kind of listening to the younger generation, which I still kind of think I'm a part of.
I think we all do. Raise your hand if you're part of the younger generation. They all go up.
The thing is, younger people, we're very passionate, and I think that we're radicals when looked at by the older generation. And sometimes I think our passion leads to anger and frustration because the things you're asking your parents and older people in the community to accept, our society is evolving really rapidly right now, and there's a lot of crazy things, and us young people are always so certain, because I'm the same way, that we're right. Because we're just so passionate. We're so, I went to college, I thought about this, and I saw it with my friends, and this is right, and this is... Where an older person has kind of seen a lot, and to them, they have the wisdom that passion is not a bad thing, and I don't think the older generation is not passionate, but they also realize it can be very destructive, and it can be hard. And so I think that older people are much more inclined to kind of take it slow, and to really kind of change is harder. And that's also a good thing, because if we were all changing really fast, our society would probably implode. So it's good that there is that there. And so I kind of, my big thought was, is that when we think of this dialogue, us young people have to realize our older folks are going to have hard times catching on with our passion, and that we need to not try to not be so angry that they aren't. And then they need to look and kind of understand, you know, that we feel so strongly, and to validate the feelings that we have. But at the same time, I think it is a good thing that they try to temper us, because I think it's something that needs to be done.
Thank you. Lloyd?
Yeah, I went to the dialogue the first night, but I wasn't able to make it to the second night.
So we kicked him off the panel.
Yeah, they kicked him off. But a couple of things I've realized is one, I don't think this is much a generational problem as it is just a problem that every generation faces, not just with people in them, but just the people around them. But an experience I had about a year, 2 years ago, was after being inactive and having disbelief for about 2 years, I decided I wanted to come back to church because I wanted this community that I used to have. And there's a lot of assumptions, I think, that people made about me. You know, what's he doing back here? Why is he always saying these weird things? And of course, me, I'm looking at them. Why are they judging me all the time? Why do they have to be thinking? Why are they so mean to me? But one Sunday, I decided. It was a fast testimony meeting, and I decided to get up in front of my ward, and I bore what I call my non-testimony. And it was a really, there's a lot of things I learned from that, because one, I put myself up there, and I went up there and I said, I'm not going to be the aggressor this time. I'm just going to explain the way I feel, explain where I have my doubts and how hard it is, but how much I want to be a part of this community, why I want to be a part of this community. And after I got done, one of the counselors in my bishopric got up and after me, and he says, wow, that was one of the most honest testimonies I've ever heard. And there's some things I realized from that. One thing I really realized is that when you're an aggressor, when you're trying to tell other people, this is what I was doing, no, this is how it is, why don't you listen to me? Because why don't you listen to me when I try to tell you that you're wrong? That nothing went anywhere. In fact, I clearly realized when you try to be an aggressor, the defense that the people have most likely is to hit you back. Whereas when you put yourself out there and make yourself vulnerable, they don't want to hit you because they realize it's not cool to hit someone who's vulnerable. Mm-hmm. And it was from that experience, from then on, also, that I realized that, wow, people actually wanted to have dialogue with me. People actually started caring, wanted to know what my opinions were. You know, people, what do you think about this Lloyd in Sunday school? And I just found that when I made myself vulnerable, stop being the aggressor, that things radically changed. I think that's what these last two guys were saying as well.
Good. Thank you. Sir, did you have a thought?
Well, yeah, I was...
I thought I had a thought. Now I'm, like, reformulating what I'm thinking. But actually, one of the things I was thinking about is sort of, like, this position of dissent. Actually, my dad and I were talking about this the other day, because I don't know how many people fit this category, but I am the son of Sunstone Mormons, so I didn't have sort of a conflict with my parents in terms of doubting or those kinds of things. They had that conflict with their parents, and so I feel like in our family we were kind of raised to just talk about every single thing, and it was really open. And I came to Sunstone when I was in high school, and that was all normal for us. Mm-hmm. But you know, for whatever reason, our family is now, even though we're cohesive in a certain way, we also have really gone in different directions. So I have a brother who is an evangelical, a liberal, politically liberal evangelical Christian. Another brother who is a politically liberal Mormon. I am a politically liberal, just sort of haven't gone to church for 10 years type person. My sister's the same way. My parents both go to church. And so it's kind of this question of dissent, it makes me think about what, like, when people react with fear to the idea of dissent, what are they afraid of? Why are they afraid of people who dissent? And it makes me think maybe they're afraid of, one idea is maybe they're afraid of this kind of fragmentation. That is, that, you know, there will be no unity, people will just go their own way and go their own directions, and we won't have a community anymore, really. Mm-hmm. And so thinking about kind of, it doesn't come easily to me to have sympathy for people who don't like dissent. This is why I was having this conversation with my dad, you know. But if I think about it, I can kind of understand why people would react with fear to dissent. Because in our, I don't know, postmodern world, the pressures on community are very intense. And it's hard to maintain any kind of stability in this world that we live in now. And so I think people are often very afraid that unity will crumble,
right,
that everything will become fragmented. And when my family gets together, we do have a certain closeness, but it's always in dialogue and it's always, yeah, in argument.
Well, as we were talking...
Is that a way to unify?
We were talking about the stages of dialogue and the stages of community. Again, there is that stage of politeness or pseudo-community where dissent and disagreement are considered liabilities or threats. And to not see them as threats or liabilities requires that vulnerability that Lloyd was talking about. Maybe we can come to our panelists and ask them if they felt at all during these 4 hours of dialogue like they had become vulnerable, and if so, was it a good or a bad experience, and how did they use it to perhaps try to further the dialogue? Any thoughts from our panelists? I could pick on my son, but I won't. He's my ride home, so.
I don't think I allowed myself to become very vulnerable during the dialogue because, I don't know, the pantheist girl in a room of Mormons, you kind of feel awkward about saying anything because there's not very many shared suppositions to operate on, and everyone's operating as though there are a lot. And it just feels so messy to correct them. But I think this round of comments, Mark and Lloyd, and I don't know your name, but thank you, and I don't know your name either, but at any rate, really got to a point that I was feeling during the dialogue. During the mediation, during the dialogue. I haven't said yet. Oh. I'm here in suspense. And that is, we were in a room full of passionate people, and I don't think the passionate people were the younger generation and the non-passionate were the older generation. We were all very passionate about very different things sometimes. And we wanted to come to the conclusion of just saying, do that deep listening, do that authentic listening, allow someone to be faithful, even if their faithfulness means something different. Allow someone to be good and to be moral, even if that goodness and morality means something quite different. But at the same time, we felt so urgently that not only do I need to be doing something a certain way, but Tristan needs to be doing something that way as well. For my own case, I get really, really troubled by overconsumption, And it's not something I can just say, oh, this is just about my personal salvation. I just want to be a good person, so I'll just worry about my own self and let other people drive their Hummers. I have a problem with it, and I want people to stop. I need them to stop. And I think it's very same way talking with Lori, who she, one of her, greatest desires is for Tristan to make it back to her Heavenly Father. And that's not something she can just relinquish and say, well, you just be your own kind of beautiful, because she needs Tristan to make it back to Heavenly Father. And so the really awkward and uncomfortable dialogue seemed to be the dialogue between absolutism and relativity, and how to function with that.
So if you weren't already sad enough or confused enough by the double bind theory, I think that I would add a bind just to liven things up. I think that the other bind on top of everything that happened in the dialogue, and I want to say parenthetically, the criticisms that we're making, I do not think mean that the dialogue was unsuccessful, but that it wasn't long enough. So I think it was very successful for how long it was. But having said that, I think that the additional problem, Tristan touched on this, but is you're talking in a room of people, you already have the double bind operating in probably every direction, and then you also have the bind of knowing what Katie said, knowing that for someone else there is an issue that maybe you disagree with completely, that is non-negotiable to them, and yet you are asking them to love you above and beyond their non-negotiables, even though it's hard for you to love them above and beyond your non-negotiables. And that's a hard part of dialogue. And also, you know, and I knew this about my parents, that it was an incredible act of love for them to be there. And it's just, I guess it's hard to know how to not sick on somebody else the things you hate being sicked on you, especially, and I keep using this word, and perhaps I'm not a minority, and certainly probably not at Sunstone, but I definitely have felt like a minority many, many, many times in my life, and I think it boils down to the problem of minorities. How, if you feel like you have been, you know, denied certain things or whatever, do you still practice forgiveness without forgiving an institution whose structures you think are doing damage? How do you try to change yourself before you change the institution without allowing the institution to do things it shouldn't do, etc.? So I think the question is really hard for anyone who perceives themselves to be in a minority position, and that doesn't mean people who agree with me, but it means anybody in a minority position. And my goal for it, we had to say what we would term success for the dialogue, and I said very honestly, success for me would be for my parents to be able to say the things that they normally hold back on saying because they love me. I would want my mom to say, I cry at night, if she does, because you don't go to church. Like, I would want her to say that and feel like she could. So really, I think we're all agonizingly aware of how hard other people were trying too, and we're working through that, and it's hard to know what to do with it sometimes. So.
Tristan, as Tristan is getting the microphone, I think one of the topics we began to get to at the end of our session, our time together, that is now coming out, is that huge elephant in the room, right? I mean, if dissent, as we were talking about, dissent and disagreement and differences of value are a characterization of genuine community, but when dissent is interpreted as endangering your eternal salvation or that of our family, I mean, how is it possible in that sort of understanding to really dialogue if you think the values of your child or your parent is going to, in fact, stop their eternal salvation? It seems like that's one of those obstacles that is almost insurmountable. But Tristan, go ahead. So see if you can solve that for us.
I think I'm going to return briefly to, I think, my earlier comment about double bind theory, because I think that one of the things that dialogue attempts to do, which I'm really grateful to it for, because this made me feel 2 hours of a haven each night those days, and it was wonderful for me, is the way that it creates what you might call an artificial structure. I mean, it takes you out of the normal context. And something that I really like, and I'm going to talk for a minute about why it doesn't work when you don't do that. So, for example, and I've had this conversation a lot of times about structures and how sometimes what bothers you is not what someone does, but the structure that they're operating within. And so, for example, it's not that they've mishandled something; it's that the actual way handling operates is the problem. And I feel like one of the reasons. When we would talk in dialogue, from the ground rules, which sometimes you should say when you feel threatened. So I did that a few times with my father. Said, when you ask this question this way, I feel a little bit threatened by that. Or, let's talk about this. And after a while, my dad said, "You are always talking about feeling threatened. I don't feel threatened. I feel comfortable with myself. I'm not sure why you feel threatened." And I think that it can be really hard for someone when they feel like you're holding them accountable for something that they didn't choose or create, right? And for me, the reason I think this is applicable to a double bind is that for me to really lay out what I was feeling, to be authentic about what I care about, I had to explain. So I spent 10 hours reading about the September 6th last week, and I just finished 4 years at BYU. So when you ask me the question, why is it that you think that the way you're living is morally acceptable, which is roughly how we phrased it, the day before the dialogue started? It was not easy to explain to him. The way you ask that, from my experience, is impossible for it to not be threatening, and my school people get expelled after they answer that question honestly. And also in my church, people get excommunicated after they answer that question honestly. The additional context, I know my father has been on church courts. I know that he doesn't just like reject that idea or something. And now I have to be honest also and say, that wasn't your fault. I mean, that's not something you chose. You didn't create that system. But I think you run into the situation where in order to be authentic, you have to talk about context. But in order to be fair to another person, sometimes you have to eliminate baggage. And context and baggage are not easy to distinguish. They're, in fact, in my mind, identical. They're not different things. I think I probably expressed what I was going to say.
Okay, well, let me kind of repackage that and reframe that. As we were talking, Cern, as you mentioned, that genuine community and genuine dialogue requires that you see differences and graceful dissent as assets to the community. Is it possible in the church to have dissent? Which means, is it possible in the church to have dialogue? Is a faithful member of the church someone who is able to say, well, when the brethren say X, I happen to disagree? And not just say that to themselves, but is there room in the church to express that dissent or that graceful disagreement in a public way? Lori, you wanted to say something. Lori is Tristan's mom, by the way. We didn't point that out, but I don't know why I just did, but
I live in Alabama, and I was late to this because I was over at the distribution center getting materials that I normally can't get and racing back. And coming from Alabama to Utah feels so artificial every time I come. And walking around, and I'm a believer. I love the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. I embrace it wholeheartedly. But coming and just being around the church office building and everybody in white shirts, it just looks odd. And it's a little bit like acclimatizing yourself to a new locale, because also in Alabama it's humid and here it's very dry, and I have been so thirsty ever since I came. But given a week or two, I would acclimatize myself to Utah, its situation, and probably even the white shirts. The interesting thing for me about having this discussion and bleeding into the Sunstone Symposium is that somehow when I was a student at BYU, I was able to be myself and still seek the spirit. And it's a very American concept to be independent and to live the music that's within your soul. And in doing, living that music within your soul is a very independent thing. So it's been interesting for me to hear that that's no longer the case at BYU. I don't know if I accept that. I'm hearing people say that, and I go, that wasn't my experience when, you know, some of you may have heard me say that when there was a fireside and we had to wear dresses, and it was wintertime, I'd just put on my jeans and put on a long coat and go to a fireside because I wanted to feel the spirit. And so what if I wasn't wearing a dress and I had to be wearing a dress? So what? And sometimes I got in trouble, like the time that I got a B plus in my typing class instead of an A that I earned and deserved, because I came to class wearing pants instead of a dress from a date where we had taken a motorcycle out to Utah Lake. But I didn't want to miss my class. See, I'm enough of a wanting to do things. I want the spirit. I want it all.
Let me, on that thought of having it all, let me turn to the group for just a second. And you might have another thought. But what I wanted to ask is if you think it's possible in the church to have graceful dissent, and if not, is dialogue in the church possible? Did you?
Sort of, I want to address that.
You can come on up.
I very clearly remember when my family joined the church in South Africa, Johannesburg, South Africa, where I'm originally from, that one of the things that greatly attracted me to the church at 11 years of age, and we kind of go to the, I can't remember the exact circumstances, but I don't know what the class was, but I go with my parents to this class, and I don't know that it was necessarily an investigator class. But the single thing that attracted me the most was that we could ask any question, which I wasn't aware that I hadn't felt that you could generally do that maybe in society or in, I'd been a Presbyterian when I was younger, but I mean, there wasn't much occasion for me to ask questions, so I don't have any real memories of that. But I was impressed by what was the apparent openness within the Mormon Church. My experience now as a 57-year-old man is that everything's gotten tighter and tighter and more closed as I've gotten older. And then I want to kind of address something because I'm also a BYU graduate. And I live with my partner now, so I'm a gay man, and I was married. I have three grown kids. And while I was right there, while I was at BYU, there was a little more freedom, I think, as you say, because I was in there in the 70s, mid-70s, late-70s, and some of the 80s. And I think definitely things have tightened up somewhat. But here I was, and looking at my life situation, I was aware of my attraction to my own sex. There was no place in that community for that, or even grasping or understanding. For heaven's sakes, I didn't understand myself. I just know that within the months before that I proposed to the woman I eventually married and married her, that I went through, or the year preceding that, there were two different roommates I had where everything was totally above board, but I knew that there were romantic feelings there. Had I known what I know now, had the church maybe been in the position it is now, because it has changed, it has made infinitesimal growth, I would have probably said, there's nothing wrong with me. Had the world been in the condition it is in now, I would probably have said, you know what, there is a possibility of me being in a loving, committed relationship with somebody that I feel compelled emotionally and physically towards. And you know what, there's possibly even the possibility that I might be able to still have that family. You know, you're raised Mormon, and I think generally in most societies,
there's some emphasis on family, and my family was somewhat dysfunctional like most. So the point I'm trying to make is that the rent, even then, somewhat at BYU were close, especially in my issues. There was no possibility of thinking of yourself as a healthy gay man or healthy lesbian. You were given all these stereotypes, which still exist amongst most Mormons' minds, of, gosh, you know, we can't be happy, right? How can we possibly be happy without the gospel and we're living in sin with our partners, just the same way heterosexuals might live in sin? So, but getting back to the thing that you're talking about, the open dialogue, I felt that closing more and more over the years, and if I were in priesthood classes to raise an honest question, even with my issues, that the ranks kind of close tightly and people just shut down, they don't want to speak about this, or the prophet has already said this, there's no, we don't want to discuss this.
Did you have a, that's, he's, yeah, thank you. Then I have one last question for the panelists, and our time is almost gone. So once again, actually, we don't have enough time. Go ahead. Yeah, when we go through all these.
I'll make this quick. I think, you know, you asked the question about, you know, whether there is a place for dissent in the church, and I absolutely feel that there is. But I do think that it's unfortunately on the burden of the dissenter to have the wisdom to know when the context is appropriate for that dissent and when it's not. And, you know, I'm not smart enough or wise enough probably to come up with any bright line rules. I think it's up to each one of us or whoever the dissenter to determine what that is. I do think that there's a, and it's a difficult balance, but it's a balance that we've all got to find within us to know when to talk about it, when to talk about things, when we can be of benefit to others by sharing our concerns, and when we're just going to be, so to speak, balloon popping, and maybe doing damage that maybe is unnecessary damage. And so I think, you know, again, it's a very personal thing. I think it's a case-by-case situation. But yeah, dissent, I think, is very healthy.
Thank you. We only have like 6 minutes left. I want to come back here, and we'll start with John, and this time we'll get my son to actually...
We were sitting here for a good one.
Oh, I'm sorry. Did you have...
Most of us had something
Oh, I'm sorry.
I got very angry with you earlier.
Good.
I asked a question here.
Yeah.
Of the panel, one person spoke, you took it away and ignored it.
Oh, I apologize for that.
I'm very passionate about this. My passion has gotten me a lot of trouble. But
well, I can't get you in trouble so.
I just want to say real quickly, yeah. 20 years ago I was an engineering manager in aerospace, and my company was in terrible morale. It was projecting $1 million loss. They didn't know how to do it. Because I had risen to that position, I wanted to try some experiments with my staff. So I called them in. I began teaching them, talking to them about some principles, which I talked about yesterday in my session. I wanted to check them out in the most hostile environment that was possible to talk about dreams. And engineering, manufacturing state. Now, that's even more hostile than the Mormon Church. In aerospace defense business. I called each member into my office and I talked to them about these principles. The morale in my department went up when we talked about dreams, because they knew that someone in responsibility was interested in them truly. Because the dream speaks the truth, and it comes from the heart. It doesn't come from the head. And it's the head that's getting in its trouble, because that's the dominator. If we have thinking up here and feeling down here, thinking does not respect feeling very much as to making decisions. On the other hand, if you go the other way, that's also dominator. That's hysteria. If on the other hand, you can turn it 90 degrees so that feelings and dreams and thinking structure can work in partnership, then they can begin to communicate. The morale in my department went out of sight. The general manager came and said, "What are you doing?" Mm-hmm. And I said, "Well, you know, you probably don't much. I don't know what it is, but can you do it for the company?" And we did it, and the experiment worked.
And the company made $1 million instead of losing $1 million that next year. I'm not talking about, that's not a bottom line thing, but it does say something about the morale.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Just to say something about the dreams, I think it is a good approach because it's less threatening. It's, you can kind of look at it as a side of yourself. A lot of things come out truthfully. But anyway, what I was going to say, actually by waiting, it really came out, my comment, by Katie and these two, just when these two spoke, I heard the word help, I wanted to help, and I'm not going to, I didn't get enough time to talk to you, so I'm not really attributing this to you, but this is what it made me think is a little suspicious, because I think when we approach a conversation with the intention to help, it's an assumption that you need me, or I have something to give you. And I just thought, within this context of the church, how can you get outside of that? Like the conversation I was telling you about that I had last night with family members, all the Mormon comments were of how to help this person. Well, why can't we assume that they're just as right as you are? They're just as fine and healthy and whole as you are. There's never that assumption. It was always of a helpfulness. So I think that really shuts down any kind of dialogue.
That's actually probably a great comment to end on since our time is up. But I want to thank the panelists for their participation and their thoughts, and for you as well for the interesting things that you said and the questions that you raised. So thank you very much. Appreciate it.